This is a topic, one of the classic HCI topics. It's like super old. I always feel like excluding it, but each time I do, each time I think about excluding it, I realize that there's even more and more reason to have this kind of stuff as part of a third year HCI class, particularly with the touch interfaces that we have today. So Fitts' Law, what it actually is it's a basic description of talking about what kinds of targets are easy to hit and what kinds of targets are hard to hit. And it has a bunch of really interesting implications for how we go about building software. To sum it up really quickly, it's really easy to hit targets that are big, right? Think about a button that's big. It's really easy to hit that bad boy. It's also very difficult to hit buttons that are far away or that are small, right? So these are kind of obvious. But as I said, they have some really interesting implications for how we go about building software. So that's Fitts' Law. So here we go. Next slide. By the end of the lecture, you should be able to describe the original Fitts' Law experiments. You should be able to describe essentially how Paul Fitts actually came to formulate the Fitts' Law description. You should be able to interpret Fitts' Law. That is, I would never ask you to kind of come up with the equation offhand, but I would ask you to explain what's going on. And then I want you to be able to identify at least two ways that Fitts' Law can be used in the interaction design, and then to be able to critique visual designs using Fitts' Law. So next slide. The punchline is kind of what I just told you. Big targets are easier to hit than small targets, and close targets are easier to hit than far targets. Okay, how hard it is to do these different things depends a little bit on what interaction device you're using. So for example, it is sometimes easier to hit these things using your finger than it is using a mouse, than it is using a pen, right? So these different interaction techniques actually have an impact on what makes it difficult and what's not. So if you have the next slide, this is one of those classic images. I think Paul Fitts did this stuff kind of back in the 50s, sort of. And what he was really interested in back at the time was basic motor skills and perception. So he was a psychologist. And what he actually did was something called a reciprocal tapping task. And so what you see here is, I'm not really sure why the pen looks like it's kind of controlled by something up the guy's sleeve. But anyway, so this is kind of one of those things, if you ever played, what's it called? Operation, you know, that little board game where you're like trying to pull things out of, you know, this guy's body. And if the metal touches the metal, then it buzzes. So this is kind of what was going on, right? Okay, so you have these two plates, right? And your goal is actually to sort of make it buzz. So this pen actually will make it buzz. And so you move this pen back and forth between these two plates. And you can see there's sort of a touchdown area. That doesn't do anything, but it kind of visually guides where you're going to hit. And you actually have a height of each one of these things too. So what's important here are the two things, two variables that he actually controlled in his experiments. What he did was he controlled the distance between these two plates. So sometimes the distance would be very close and other times it'd be quite far apart. And then he also varied the width of these things. So the actual sort of hittable area was sometimes quite wide and sometimes quite narrow. So he varied these things as a way of trying to understand, you know, if we were to design things where people have to do things regularly. So think about kind of machinery back in the day. So maybe like, you know, automotive building kind of scenarios, right? So his goal was try to understand the nature of worker efficiency. Such as in a production line and assembly task, right? So if we understand what are the factors that make people effective and efficient, then we can design workspaces where they are going to be, you know, effective and efficient. So if you hit the next slide, it turns out that this happens in GUIs as well, right? Right. So if you're moving your mouse around, the distance you have to move your mouse, that's the amplitude or the length. The width of the target itself, that's the width of the target. So this is almost a direct analog to the kinds of stuff that Paul Fitts was actually doing. So the example here is a mouse pointer over a button. So it's obviously not quite perfect because this button is like a little bit square. It's not round, right? The other thing, too, is that when Fitts was doing his original experiments, he was thinking about sort of this one-dimensional case, whereas on at least conventional GUIs, you have a two-dimensional workspace, right? So what Fitts actually did was he collected a lot of data across a lot of different people, varying the width and the amplitude a bunch of different ways. And if you take a look at the next slide, what he did was he plotted this data out. Okay, so the plot you'll actually see on slide number 7. So he actually plotted this data out, and then he drew a regression line, or a line that basically is a model that has a good fit with the data. Okay, turns out that it's a linear equation. If you go back to slide 6, I'll actually explain what's happening here. So MT is movement time. How much time does it take to move? Is a function, essentially. So this is A and B component of the log of 2 times A, or the amplitude, the distance to the target, divided by width. And that's it. That's all there is to it. And A and B, and little a and little b, are empirically determined constants. So they're typically a function, essentially, of the input device. Right, so different input devices give us different A's and B's. Take a look at the next slide. That's basically it. So he'd get these dots, and then he plotted this line, and then you plot this line through it, and then you figure out what your A and B are. What we would say is that that whole log term is something we call index of difficulty, right? So that encapsulates both the amplitude and the width, and also that log term. And the other thing that they would use sometimes, they would have this term called index of performance, or IP, and that was calculated by using 1 over little b. So I told you earlier that little a and little b are empirically determined constants, typically a function essentially of the difficulty of use of the input device. So b is the one that is a function of the index of difficulty, so that sort of makes sense. A, the little a, you can think of as kind of the performance cost of actually just using the device, maybe picking it up or whatever it might be. So if you hit the next slide, the two major implications of Fitts' law is that it allows us to design navigation, and it allows us to evaluate input devices and techniques. So if you hit the next slide, all I've done here is I've grabbed you a screenshot of my computer, right? So I want you to stop here for a moment, and I want you to think about what the targets are here. What are all the different things that I can click? And I want you to list these things out. As you're doing this, I want you to think about which are big, which are easy to click. You know, which place do I need to be coming from to make them easy to click? So I'll pause right here and let you do that. Okay, we're back. So some of the things that are very easy to click, and some of the things that are difficult to click, and what are some of the targets, right? So obviously some of the things are the Chrome, right? Some of the buttons, right? The red, yellow, and green little buttons on the top left-hand corner, the back button, the reload button. These are all fairly small targets, but they're targets nevertheless. The little X button on the tab, that's another target, but it's also fairly small. Some of the bigger targets that you can actually click are things like some of the links, or perhaps the text box, both in the URL bar and the search field. The other thing I want to draw your, and so on and so forth, so we can do this, right? So what are some of the things that are easier to click, right? So the things that you want people to be doing, you want to make it easy for them to click, right? Things that you don't want people to think carefully about, make it more difficult for them to click. You want to make it a little smaller, perhaps. Perhaps, not always. One of the things I want to draw your attention to is the menu bar at the very top. So if you've never used a Mac before, this menu basically appears on a per application basis. One of the menu items that never changes is that a little Apple thing on the top left. But anyway, this menu bar, what's really fascinating about it is that it's an infinitely tall menu bar. This means that I can kind of move my mouse to the file menu, and I can actually keep pushing it up past where the mouse should actually be, and it'll still work. So it is infinitely large, which means that it's actually an infinitely wide menu item. So that makes it very easy to click. Same thing with the mouse or the Apple thing. So if you take a look at it and you actually use it, you can actually punch your mouse to the top left-hand corner as hard as you want. It's infinitely large, which makes it very, very easy to use. So with that knowledge in mind, I want you to take a look at the next slide and think about the answer to the following question. The Microsoft toolbars offer the user the option of displaying a label below each tool. I want you to give two reasons why labeled tools can be accessed faster. Assume that the user already knows a tool and does not need the labels to identify the tool. So the reason for this is actually right on the slide. So hopefully you just did that without looking. But anyway, the label actually becomes the target. The label's part of the target, so it's actually bigger and easier to hit. The other thing is that when labels are not used, the tool icons actually crowd together. So moving your mouse between these items becomes a lot more difficult, right? So the labels actually space out the buttons a little bit, and they reduce the number of errors that you create or like that result, and they also make it easier to differentiate. If you take a look at the next slide, so we're on slide 11 again. Again, the answer is sitting right there, so hopefully you're watching this as a presentation. But anyway, the question is, assume that you have this layout of buttons on the left edge of the screen. Without changing the size of these icons, what can you do to decrease the amount of time it takes to access the tools? There are actually a bunch of different ways to do this. I'll take a pause here to see if you can think through them. And we're back. So one of the ways you can do it is actually change the array to 1 by 12. And the other thing that you might want to do is ensure that you can click the pixels to the left of the button too, right? This makes it infinitely large, just like we did with the menu bar up in OS X. What I'm going to do in class is I'm going to introduce a couple of different input techniques. One's called Swift Point, another one is called Bubble Cursor, another one's called Edge Right. And I'll show you how these interfaces actually make use of that Fitts' Law principle and why they actually work well in doing so. What I'm showing you in the next slide here, this is slide number 12. This is an interface that kind of one of the early Pocket PC or Windows Phone interfaces. And what you see here is, I'll describe some of the problems that this interface had, and problems that could have easily been avoided had the designers been well aware of Fitts' Law and took that into consideration as they designed this interface. So one of the problems, of course, with mobile devices, and that's why I think Fitts' Law is interesting, because we're typically dealing with mobile devices that have small screens, and we're typically interacting with these things using touch, is that it becomes, you know, a very crowded space. It becomes very difficult to click on certain things and to tap on certain things. I had one of the early devices that had this version of Pocket PC on it. It was a iPad Compact. And so you can see what's going on here, there are kind of two buttons at the bottom, up and menu. The top left, there's the start button. Along the top there, there's the notification tray, so all the applications that are sort of running and sort of shortcuts to them. In the top right-hand corner, you've got the X button that closes the application that you're looking at. So a lot of the things that were really annoying about this interface, the other thing too is that you can see a couple of drop-downs. There's the My Device drop-down, and on the right side underneath the X you can create a new folder there. That's the folder with the star icon on it. At least I think that's what you could do. Maybe that was my favorites folder. I can't remember. Anyway, one of the things you can see here is that the placement of the targets, right, all the different things that I can click, they're really close to each other. And so it was extremely common to click the wrong thing because of something that you would get some visual parallax. And what that is essentially where the screen is actually being displayed, you've got a piece of glass on top. And so you've probably experienced this where you tap on something and where you think you're tapping based on what you can see, it looks like you're going to hit the right thing, but the touch screen actually interprets it in a different way. And this was a real problem with the Pocket PCs, the early generations of these. You'd have these ridiculous levels of visual parallax. And so you'd think you'd be clicking on something, and then some other target actually gets raised altogether. So the targets were really small. They were really close together. It was very common to click the wrong thing. The scroll bar was very annoying to use. I don't know if it's particularly visible in this screenshot, but actually just to the right of the scroll bar, it was in an inactive region. There's like a pixel of inactiveness. And so if you were so unlucky as to start dragging the scroll bar and then you move your pen a little bit to the right, it would sort of lose contact with the scroll and then you would stop scrolling altogether. It was really, really annoying. So we do different kinds of things now, right? One of the questions that I typically ask is, what are the solutions that we used right now? And what is the issue with discoverability? So if you pull out your phone right now, I think in any modern version of iOS and any modern version of Android, and you scroll, you'll actually see the scroll bar pop up. But if you stop scrolling, the scroll bar will disappear. And you might say, okay, well, this saves you some screen real estate. This is a good thing. But one of the problems is when you're navigating a large document, and you probably experienced this in your lifetime already, is that when you don't have a scroll bar, you don't know how far much further you have to go. And so this is an issue when you're making decisions about whether you should finish an article, for example, or if you're searching through something and taking a look, right? So Fitt's Law has a really big impact, particularly when we think about touch interfaces. I'll take you to the next slide. This is one of the podcasts I listen to. It's called This American Life. And I'm showing you two different screenshots here. The screenshot on the left is what Facebook shows me, or their Facebook page shows me. And the screenshot on the right is what their mobile application actually shows. Some of the primary actions when it comes to dealing with one of these things is to like it or to comment on it. And you can see that actually... you can see that in the sort of web page version of this on the left. The like and the comment button are really close together, and they're really tiny targets. In contrast, the like and the comment button are massive, and they're sort of in principle sort of far apart. I know they're right next to each other, but they look visually kind of far apart. And the reason that they do this on the phone version is because your finger is relatively quite large, whereas with a mouse, it's actually quite easy to control. The other thing with a mouse is that you can actually leave it. You can let go of the mouse and it will stay there. So in some ways, the index of difficulty for using a mouse is actually quite low. All right, so that brings us to the end of Fitt's Law. It's actually a very brief idea, but it actually has some really interesting implications for how you go about designing software and designing navigation in your software. How big should targets be? How far apart should they be? Right? And this should harken back to some of the heuristic stuff that we talked about, right? So in particular, you can use this idea to prevent certain kinds of slips, right? So you would never want to have actions with catastrophic results immediately next to actions that are very common to use, right? So, for example, you would never want the save menu item to be immediately next to the delete menu item because that's a very easy slip to make, right? Or you'd want it there to, and in fact, you'd want there to be some distance between those two actions. Okay, so that brings us to the end. Thank you so much for your attention.